We're also very fortunate to have Anthony Aronov with us tonight, author of Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal. He was here a few nights ago with Studs Terkel on the National End the War Tour, which is organized by the New Press, International Socialist Review, Alternate in These Times, IVAW, and Campus Anti-War Network. He's the editor of Iraq Under Siege, co-editor with Howard Zinn of Voices of a People's History of the United States. His writing is pretty prolific, appearing in Financial Times, The Nation, Mother Jones, Monthly Review, and several other publications. We're very happy to have him here with us. And so please, welcome Anthony Aronov.
A lot. It's an honor to be here and to speak with Suzanne and to speak with Juan, and to be connected with Campus Anti-War Network, which, as I go around the country, I've been talking about as an example of the organizing that's happening, and particularly when people ask about what's happening on the campuses, what are students doing, as a model of how students can play an important role in building the anti-war movement. And that movement, if you go back and you look at history, the student anti-war movement during the Vietnam War played a very important role. I think there was a discussion about that earlier I saw on the agenda. And it will play a very important role as this movement develops, and it's already played one. You look at, for example, the figures on recruitment for the military, and it is significant. It is important. 3 years into this war, the U.S. military is having a harder time recruiting people to fight in Iraq, despite the lies, despite the money, despite the increased incentives that they're trying to use to get people into the military. They're having the worst recruitment crisis since right after the Vietnam War. That's because people are looking what's happening in the war, they're seeing through the lies, but it's also because people are going out, they're organizing, are protesting, are kicking recruiters off campus, are confronting them about the lies that they tell to get people into the military, and people are speaking out, and people like Juan are saving lives, and people like Campus Anti-War Network are saving lives by doing that work. There's no question about that. The situation we confront today is a contradictory one. I think, we have to take stock of where we're at if we're gonna have a sense of how to move forward. But we're 3 years into this occupation, and I think a couple of things are clear. The first thing that's clear, I think it's important to reiterate, that the anti-war movement was absolutely right about everything we said about this war. If you go back to the beginning, to all the lies that they used to sell the invasion of Iraq, that they used to sell regime change in Iraq, every one of those lies we confronted, we exposed, we challenged as an anti-war movement, whether it was al-Qaeda being in Iraq, or Iraq being connected to 9/11, or Iraq being this imminent threat to the United States, or the idea that the Iraqi people would greet U.S. soldiers with sweets and flowers. It would be a quick occupation. It would be a cheap occupation. U.S. soldiers would be coming home just in a matter of a couple of months. The occupation would be paid for by Iraqi oil, and then there's going to be a sweeping a process of democratization throughout the Middle East, backed by the benevolence of U.S. power in Iraq. And all of those things we as an anti-war movement challenged, and each one of them has been exposed, although the media hasn't changed its behaviors as a result of that. It's not as if the media is now coming to Juan, as if the media is coming to the anti-war movement for analysis or perspective or to understand how did we get it so wrong and how did you get it right. No, they're going back to the same pundits. They're going back to the same politicians who lied to them before, but now they're giving them a whole new set of lies, which they're putting on the front page of the paper just like they put the old lies on the front page of the paper. The United States is bringing democracy to Iraq. That's the new lie, the new big lie. The United States is stopping civil war in Iraq. That's the other big lie. And that the United States is stopping proliferations of weapons of mass destruction, setting up a kind of a firewall in the Middle East against terrorism and the threat of terrorism. All of those things are lies, and they're new lies that are being used to sell the occupation of Iraq and the possibility of regime change in other countries to a skeptical public. And when I say it's a mixed picture, it's important to stress that the public opinion on this war, which was against it before it happened, but then was swung into support for it through those lies, that idea of Iraq is a threat, Iraq has biological weapons, Iraq has chemical weapons, it has these mobile weapons labs, the ironclad case that supposedly Colin Powell laid out in his case to the United Nations. As all of those things have been exposed, and as they've come up with new lies, we, as an anti-war movement, have to confront them, but also public opinion has shifted drastically, so that now a majority of people in this country oppose the war. A majority of people think the invasion should have never taken place. It was a mistake. And a majority of people want the troops to come home. The other significant thing is the recent poll that came out of public opinion among soldiers in Iraq. I mean, keep in mind, soldiers are disciplined, punished for thinking independently. They're told only to follow orders. They're told that they're never allowed to have a political opinion or have a criticism when they're in the military. They just are to do whatever their commanders say. The soldiers in Iraq, seeing the contradiction between what they were told they would be doing, liberating people, helping people, building schools, and then the reality of what they're doing, killing people, in some cases torturing people, being sent out in patrols into neighborhoods where they're harassing and haranguing people who are resisting them, who oppose them, who resent their presence, who are greeting them not as liberators but as occupiers. Those soldiers now, 72% of them say they want to come home within a year, and 23% say immediately, which is significant. I think those numbers are actually underestimate the degree of sentiment for getting out of Iraq. Given the kind of pressures that are on soldiers to conform, not to speak out, not to think independently. And it's very clear also what the Iraqi people think. It's clear in the demonstrations, it's clear in the daily forms that resistance takes in Iraq, and it's also clear in the opinion polls that have been done. And that's where the whole idea of the United States bringing democracy to Iraq really is so immediately a contradiction. If you are going to bring democracy to the Iraqi people, then let's let the Iraqi people answer a couple of basic questions. Do you want to be under occupation? Yes or no? Let's let the Iraqi people answer that question. It's very clear what they think about that. The U.S. troops would be gone if it were up to the Iraqi people. What about the oil resources of Iraq? What do the Iraqi people want the oil resources? What do they want done with the oil resources? Well, again, that's also very clear. They want the oil resources put to national development, to local needs, not to benefit Western oil companies, not to benefit the United States. There was an opinion poll that was done right after the invasion of Iraq, asking Iraqis, why do you think the United States intervened? 1% said to liberate the Iraqi people. 1%. That's like the 2% of African Americans who said they approve of Bush. It's a statistical anomaly. It's like it means zero with the margin of error factored in. And, you know, it's like, you know, they got, well, okay. But so they got 1% who believe it was to liberate the people of Iraq. What did they think the reason was for the invasion was? To take control of the resources of Iraq, the energy resources of Iraq, and to reorder the Middle East in a way that would be beneficial to the United States and beneficial to its main ally in the region, Israel. And that's absolutely the real reason for this occupation. Nothing about democracy, nothing about human rights, nothing about terrorism. As Suzanne pointed out very accurately, a whole series of things that were in place in the Clinton administration under the Democrats with regard to Iraq, with regard to the Middle East, with regard to a whole series of foreign policy and domestic policy objectives. When 9/11 happened, it was a green light to advance an agenda that had nothing to do with fighting terrorism or bringing democracy to the Middle East, but had to do with expanding American dominance and control of that region, and through control of that region, extending geopolitical control globally. Because the Middle East, it's not just about whether or not the United States imports oil from Iraq and brings it to the SUVs of people in the suburbs of Chicago. That's not what it's about. It's about the power that comes from controlling Iraqi oil. It's about the fact that when the United States looks down into the future and they see the potential rivals to its status as a sole superpower, able to intervene militarily, economically, politically, in people's affairs all around the world, in countries in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, wherever it is that they want to open up markets or control people, they see that China is emerging in the future. They talk very openly about it. We're seeing a lot of it right now with the president of China visiting. They see India emerging. They see countries in Europe, and particularly with the European Union, emerging as potential rivals. And they notice something, which is that those countries import far more of their energy resources from the Middle East than does the United States. And they understand that an immense amount of power comes over those other countries if the United States controls the oil of Iraq. If the United States then can use Iraq as a staging ground for military intervention, projection of power in the region, which has two-thirds of world oil reserves, and which also has very important natural gas reserves. And you look right next door to Iraq, Iran. It right now is the second largest exporter of oil in the world, Iran, and is one of the leading countries that has natural gas reserves. And even as short-sighted and oil-addicted as the people who run the United States are, they understand that oil supplies are dwindling and that they're going to have to develop natural gas as a potential supplement to or alternative to oil. And so they're looking down the line to controlling natural gas, not just to controlling oil. So the situation in Iraq is blowing up in their face. Public opinion is against the war. Bush's popularity rating is the worst of any president since Nixon. During the Watergate crisis, not at any just random time in his administration, the public criticism that's now emerging within the ranks of the military, certain generals voicing criticism, you know, over tactical differences, we have to be clear, limited criticisms, but tactical differences that open up cracks among elite opinion about the war. And in that context, all of the things that the administration said would happen in Iraq, not happening, the thing blowing up in their face. But it's not in that situation, it's not as if the Bush administration, as if the Democrats and Republicans are going to be rational people and they're going to look at the situation and they're going to conclude that they've done something horrible in Iraq and that they're just going to fold up shop and come home. Because a lot is at stake for them. Not only all of the power calculations that led them to go into Iraq in the first place, but now the fact that the legitimacy of U.S. empire would be called into question if they were defeated in Iraq. Their ability to intervene in other countries would be hampered, and they see that, and they know what happened after the Vietnam War, when the Vietnam War syndrome limited their ability to intervene in other countries' affairs, made the American public very skeptical about the projection of military power for a number of years. They wanted to get rid of that by going into Iraq, and it would blow up even more. It would be even more significant than the Vietnam syndrome if they were defeated in Iraq. And so when the Bush administration starts talking about Iran the way they are talking about Iran right now, I think we have to take it deadly seriously. If you go back to the Vietnam War, by 1967, when Howard Zinn wrote Vietnam, The Logic of Withdrawal, which is the book that was the inspiration for Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, the book I just wrote, by 1967, Howard laid out an ironclad case for immediate withdrawal, that the war was the United States had lost the war in Vietnam. He was opposed to it from the beginning. But, you know, from the standpoint of the objectives of military power of the United States, that it could not win in Vietnam. And in 1968, you have the Tet Offensive, a decisive military defeat for the United States. But did they retreat? No, they actually escalated the war and expanded the war into Laos, into Cambodia. Millions of people died before the U.S. was finally compelled to leave Vietnam. And for us, I think we have to take that same challenge very seriously. The United States might expand this war. There's more at stake for them in Iraq than was at stake in 1967 in Vietnam, if you look at how Vietnam fit into the world as an economic and political force. It compares, it doesn't even begin to compare with the importance of Iraq in terms of its geography, its resources, what it symbolizes for the objectives of U.S. imperialism. So it's not only that they might expand the war, but they are talking about intensifying the war. People may have heard of the El Salvador option. This is happening. This is not just abstract ideas. They've armed death squads in Iraq. They're distributing large supplies of weapons. They are encouraging civil war. Far from being the case that U.S. presence in Iraq is preventing civil war from breaking out, it is encouraging and fueling sectarian divisions and conflict. Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist, openly advocated this. He said we should arm the Shia, arm the Kurds, and let the Sunni reap the wind, advocating civil war in the pages of the New York Times. He's the liberal columnist, by the way. This is not, this is not Rush Limbaugh. This is the liberal opinion, the respectable opinion of the New York Times. Then the Wall Street Journal, a week ago, people may have seen, there was a column in which a strategy that's being discussed now among some of the military people who are critical of the strategy in Iraq was being floated. This sometimes happens where the military has an idea and it gets expressed through someone like the American Enterprise Institute or the Heritage Foundation on the pages of the Wall Street Journal or other magazines and newspapers, and they are now talking about intensifying counterinsurgency operations in Iraq, specifically in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq. And the article called for pacification of Baghdad, even though it said it would lead to skyrocketing body counts and horrific images that would fuel anger and resentment around the world. But that's what we have to do. We have to intensify. So the possibility of an expansion into Iran, the possibility of intensification of this conflict are very real unless there's an escalation of opposition. And turning the sentiment, like the poster for this conference says, turning anti-war sentiment into organized expression, civil disobedience, protest, the kinds of things that can disrupt business as usual. And if you go back to the Vietnam War, I describe in the book how basically five factors came together to compel the United States to leave Vietnam. The first was the resistance of the Vietnamese people, widespread, massive resistance to the war. The second was the opposition at home. The U.S. lost the war at home. And you go back and you look at the internal discussions and Nixon and Johnson talking very openly about we've lost the war of public opinion. There's civil disobedience in the streets. They were losing control of the system, and they were afraid of the consequences of that. There was a rebellion in the military, which was a decisive element. It's often ignored element. But thankfully, there's now a film out, which I think is a tremendous organizing tool. People should get it, watch it, use it as an organizing tool called Sir, No Sir. It's just coming out in theaters. It's a fantastic documentary about the GI Rebellion during the Vietnam War, the amazing creative organizing that soldiers and veterans did against the war. And there's a book about this, the same story, Soldiers in Revolt, by David Courtwright from Goshen, Indiana, with a new foreword by Howard Zinn, published by Haymarket Books, that tells the story. It's an amazing story. And Courtwright and Zinn bring it all the way up to today in Iraq, and the beginning of an emergence of soldiers like Camilo Mejia, Pablo Paredes, and others speaking out and the importance of that. The fourth and fifth elements were the fact that the United States grew more isolated politically on the international stage, and the costs of the war grew to the point that it had an impact on elites. It was hurting the U.S. economy. There was these cracks opening up at the top that the anti-war movement could take advantage of. And all of those elements are in place today, but none of them alone is strong enough. To stop this war. We see the cracks emerging. We see the opposition in Iraq. we see the economic consequences of this war increasing. But we have to do what we can, which is to strengthen that military resistance, lend whatever support we can to military families, to veterans, to soldiers who are speaking out against this war. And that's why groups like Iraq Veterans Against the War and Gold Star Families are so important. We have to do everything we can to support their work, but also to build the war at home so that they lose it, that they lose the battle of public opinion, they lose control of the campuses like they did during the Vietnam War. And that's where a group like Campus Anti-War Network can play a decisive role in galvanizing that sentiment, channeling it into the kind of effective protests that can help end this war. Because it's not that just, so much is at stake, not just in Iraq, but really in the world, to forcing the United States out of Iraq. And I'll just I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Thank you so much. The next stops on the End the War Tour are May 1st in San Francisco and May 8th in Seattle, where Anthony will be speaking with Cindy Sheehan. In June, he'll be in London. And there's a blog that is documenting the tour at endthewartour.org.